Good morning. I'm your host, and this is your geopolitical risk briefing for April 29th, 2026. Let's start with a power shift that should have every strategic analyst paying close attention, because what we're witnessing inside Russia right now is not a blip. It is a convergence. A convergence of internal economic collapse, elite dissent breaking into the open, and a Ukrainian military campaign that is systematically dismantling the infrastructure Moscow depends on to sustain its war. Let's begin in Moscow, specifically inside the Russian State Duma, where something unusual happened on April 15th. Gennady Zyuganov, the leader of the Communist Party, stood before a plenary session of the Russian parliament and warned, explicitly, that without urgent financial, economic, and structural reform, a repeat of what happened in 1917 awaits Russia by autumn. Now, to understand why that matters, you have to understand what Zyuganov is and what he is not. He is not a fringe figure. The Communist Party is a tolerated, systemic opposition vehicle inside the Russian political framework. What makes this moment different is the venue, the State Duma floor, and the specificity of his indictment. He wasn't trafficking in vague populist grievance. He was delivering a structurally precise critique of the socio-economic system Putin has constructed over 25 years, and he was doing it in the most institutionally visible forum available to him. On the same day Zyuganov was invoking 1917, Vladimir Putin was publicly scolding his top economic officials. The strategic calculus here is worth noting carefully. In authoritarian systems, public blame displacement towards subordinates is a classic accountability management mechanism. It signals that the leadership recognizes a problem it cannot solve, but cannot afford to own. That is not a posture of confidence. That is a posture of institutional stress management. And the numbers behind that stress are stark. Economy Development Minister Maxim Reshnikov confirmed publicly at a business conference that Russia's financial reserves have, in his words, largely been used up. Russia's central bank survey data from April shows that 64% of Russian companies plan no staff changes in 2026, and 14% are planning layoffs. That is a labor market in demand contraction, not the mobilization signature of a wartime economy performing at capacity. Building on that, Russia's external debt has reached nearly $62 billion, reportedly a 20-year high last seen in January 2006, while combined state and private external debt rose over 10% in 2025 to $319 billion. And then there's the approval rating. According to the Russian Public Opinion Research Center, Putin's approval has fallen to 65.6%, down from 73.3% at the start of March. That is a 7.7 percentage point decline across 7 consecutive weeks, the lowest approval figure since the Ukraine invasion began. The strategic calculus here connects directly to September's electoral cycle. Zyuganov is navigating a deliberate corridor, genuine political positioning ahead of elections, while simultaneously issuing what amounts to a sophisticated structural indictment. His invocation of 1917 represents a meaningful expansion of the permissible space of elite dissent inside Russia. The question analysts must ask is not whether revolution is imminent, it is not, but whether these are leading indicators of managed decline or accelerating fracture. The convergence of a serving cabinet minister confirming reserve depletion, 7 consecutive weeks of falling approval, and an explicit opposition framing of the ballot as an alternative to extra-institutional action constitutes a signal set that warrants serious forward monitoring. Now, here's the second-order dimension that makes this even more consequential. Ukraine is not passively waiting for Russian economics to do the work. Kyiv is actively compressing Russia's remaining fiscal oxygen. Ukraine's systematic targeting of Russian oil export infrastructure has reduced crude sales by approximately 300,000 barrels per day and refined product sales by roughly 200,000 barrels per day. The Financial Times reported Russia was generating an additional $150 million per day in oil revenues in March due to Iran-driven price increases. Ukraine's interdiction campaign has substantially eroded that windfall. The coercive dimension of the labor market deterioration compounds this further. As civilian hiring freezes and layoffs accelerate, the Kremlin's primary absorption mechanism for unemployed labor is military recruitment,
echoing precisely the coercive mobilization dynamic of 1917 that Zhuganov explicitly references. Now, let's turn to the battlefield innovation that is reshaping the operational calculus in occupied Donetsk, and it's a development confirmed by an unlikely source. On April 6th, TASC, Russia's own state news agency, reported that Ukraine deployed graphite payload drones against power facilities in Russian-occupied Donetsk. The drones detonated midair, dispersing fine graphite threads over electrical infrastructure. Three drones successfully released payloads over power facilities. And here's the detail that redefines the defensive calculus. Post-engagement examination of destroyed drones revealed graphite filaments in the wreckage, confirming that even successfully intercepted drones dispersed their payload in the vicinity of the intercepting Russian air defense systems themselves. The strategic calculus here is elegant and ruthless. Russia's air defense batteries are positioned to protect high-value assets that are predominantly electrical in nature. When those batteries intercept a graphite-carrying drone, the payload disperses immediately around the intercepting system, creating a self-targeting dynamic in which Russian defensive success generates collateral contamination of the infrastructure the defense was designed to protect. This is not a novel concept. It's a novel delivery mechanism. The United States first deployed carbon fiber warheads via Tomahawk cruise missiles against Iraqi electrical infrastructure in the early 1990s. NATO deployed filament-based soft bombs against Yugoslavia in 1999, achieving what a Guardian report described as a 70% nationwide power blackout in Serbia, a blackout that neutralized Serbian air defenses, including systems that had already downed a US F-117 Nighthawk stealth aircraft. That NATO-Yugoslavia case is the most operationally analogous precedent here. Yugoslavia had demonstrated the capability to defeat stealth aircraft, a qualitative air defense achievement analogous to Russia's documented ability to intercept Ukraine's conventional drone campaign at scale. NATO's graphite campaign targeted the electrical dependency of that network. Ukraine is executing an identical strategic logic in occupied Donetsk.
More importantly, Ukraine holds substantial domestic graphite reserves, ranking as the world's fourth largest graphite producer between 2022 and 2024, with estimated reserves of nearly 18 million tons. There is no near-term resource constraint on this capability, and the weapon carries a sophisticated post-conflict logic. Graphite damage is reversible through component replacement and system cleaning. Ukraine is implicitly managing its own future reconstruction exposure by choosing a weapon that temporarily disables rather than permanently destroys infrastructure it intends to recover after the war. That is strategic thinking operating well beyond the immediate tactical horizon. Let's shift now to the hardening of Western alliance support, and specifically to Spain, which has formalized a commitment that deserves more attention than it has received. On April 22nd, Spain's Defense Minister Margarita Robles and Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister Fedorov held a bilateral defense ministerial, at which Spain confirmed delivery of 100 VAMTAC ST-5 armored tactical vehicles and an unspecified quantity of 155mm artillery ammunition beginning in May. Spain has committed 1 billion euros in total assistance through 2026 and will have trained over 9,000 Ukrainian soldiers by end of April 2025. The country has already transferred 5 Patriot PAC-2 interceptor missiles, each valued at $3 to $4 million, as a stopgap amid supply bottlenecks. The strategically significant dimension here is not the individual platform, it is the system's integration architecture. The United Kingdom independently purchased VAMTACs from Spain in July 2024, specifically to mount its Rapid Ranger short-range air defense system, validation that NATO allies have converged on this vehicle system pairing as a common architecture for the final layer intercept role. Spain provides the mobility platform. The UK provides the sensor shooter package in the form of the Rapid Ranger mounting the Martlet lightweight multi-role missile, which engages targets at up to 7 kilometers using combined infrared and laser guidance, effective against low thermal signature targets such as Russia's Shahed-type strike drones. Ukraine reportedly received hundreds of Martlet missiles approximately 6 months ahead of schedule in October 2024. The strategic calculus here directly contradicts Putin's core strategic hypothesis. His theory of victory has consistently relied on the belief that Western unity is brittle, that economic pressure, war fatigue, or political fragmentation would erode European support. Spain's trajectory, from political solidarity to operationally integrated material support, formalized industrial partnership, and soldier training, mirrors Germany's prior strategic recalibration from non-lethal aid to Leopard 2 transfers. The 5 bilateral agreements signed in March covering joint defense production represent a structural industrial relationship independent of active combat status, one that persists through any ceasefire scenario. Building on that,
Spain's trajectory echoes NATO's Cold War short-range air defense standardization approach, in which deliberate convergence on common architectures across alliance members was treated as a force multiplier independent of any single member's contribution scale. That precedent matters because it signals that even historically cautious southern flank NATO members are recalculating their defense posture in ways that will outlast the immediate conflict. Before I bring this briefing home, let me briefly touch on two additional fault lines that are reshaping the strategic landscape. First, Kazakhstan. The Kremlin's Dmitry Peskov publicly stated that Russian authorities believe drones that struck Russian territory were launched from Kazakhstan, framing the determination of the source and the measures required as a military rather than diplomatic prerogative. Regardless of the attribution's veracity, this fits a recognizable Russian coercive pattern used against Georgia between 2004 and 2008, and against Moldova. Ambiguous cross-border accusations that apply pressure on nominally aligned states without triggering the legal threshold for collective defense responses. Kazakhstan has carefully maintained formal neutrality on Ukraine, refusing to endorse the invasion at the United Nations while diversifying toward Western and Chinese partners. Its pipeline transit dependencies and remittance flows limit its escalational options. The form Kazakhstan chooses for its official response, bilateral diplomatic denial versus multilateral escalation to the CSTO or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, will be a leading indicator of whether Nursultan is seeking Chinese diplomatic cover to constrain Russian unilateralism. Second, inside the United States, three concurrent institutional stress events are reshaping domestic political geography with compounding strategic consequences. A redistricting war explicitly framed by House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries as, quote, maximum warfare everywhere all the time, end quote, is producing maps in Virginia designed for 10-to-1 Democratic advantage, and countermaps in Florida targeting 24-to-4 Republican advantage. Senator Ron Johnson is openly calling for elimination of the Senate legislative filibuster, and Citadel's internal communications have documented the firm's potential withdrawal of a planned 1,600-foot Park Avenue tower, representing $6 billion in investment and over 20,000 permanent jobs, part of an accelerating capital reallocation from New York toward Florida, where 2.3 million net new residents have relocated since COVID. These three developments are structurally linked. Each reflects the collapse of the cooperative norms that historically moderated partisan excess, and each compounds the institutional erosion the others produce. In a geopolitical environment requiring sustained strategic attention and coherent alliance management, domestic institutional fragmentation of this scale carries real external consequences. Now, the one regional signal I want you to monitor in the next 48 hours. Watch Kazakhstan's official response to the Kremlin's drone attribution claim, specifically the forum chosen, bilateral or multilateral, and the timeline. A delayed Kazakhstani response would suggest Nursultan is consulting with Beijing before answering Moscow. That would be a leading indicator of Chinese diplomatic intervention in the Russia-Kazakhstan friction, a development with significant implications for Russia's eastern flank stability at precisely the moment its Western military campaign is consuming fiscal reserves at an unsustainable rate. If Beijing woos to constrain Russian coercion of a fellow CSTO member, it signals a meaningful recalibration of the China-Russia partnership's operating boundaries. That is a signal that would ripple across every theater we've discussed today. Thank you for joining me for today's geopolitical risk briefing. That's your strategic intelligence assessment for April 29th, 2026. We'll be back tomorrow with updated signpost monitoring across the Russia-Ukraine economic warfare corridor, the Kazakhstan friction point, and the European defense integration architecture. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your CR brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.